Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Hooten, Judge Riley, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated. Our first case this morning is the State of Minnesota versus recognize this person, Jonathan Humane. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust the podium to your level, and please tell us who you are and love Griffiths.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant, Jonathan Humane, in this appeal. At the district court, Mr. Humane raised a collateral attack against his prior conviction. That was premised on a series of undoubtedly unique cases. I mean, this case law has been everywhere, starting with Schreiner and working through. We've got McNeely, we've got Bernard, Birchfield, Trahan, Thompson, Johnson, Morehouse, the Johnson that actually authorized retroactive attacks against these convictions, and then the recent Fagan case that was even explaining procedurally how that takes place. So based on all of those changes in the law, he brought this collateral attack saying that his conviction was unconstitutionally obtained. Specifically, not only the method that was used to obtain the conviction, but the statute that was used in order to obtain that conviction. In this specific context, it's the same coin, different sides when you're dealing with whether somebody, you know, refused to submit to a test and was charged with an unconstitutional crime or gave in to the unconstitutional threat and did submit to the test. And the district court found that. They found that this was a violation of his constitutional rights.
But it seems like the key argument here, and I hope I'm not misstating it, and I'm sure that the respondent will let me know, but is that this, even if you threw out the results of the blood test as being unconstitutionally obtained, there's still sufficient evidence in this record to support a DWI. And then you, of course, have the admissions of your client that he was drinking.
Yeah, no, and that was what the district court found, was that there is adequate evidence to have convicted Mr. Humane back then.
That's the issue here, and that's how we should be analyzing this case?
That's what I would like the court to focus on. I mean, that's the state's argument. That was the court's conclusion. I think here, this is fundamentally different, and it was unpublished, but it's instructive that the Nordstrom decision that came from this court that did find exactly that, where the conviction was for driving while impaired, where impairment was something that needed to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't think, as a matter of law, the court can reach that conclusion when the conviction is for the per se crime, where the only way for a jury to convict somebody is by finding beyond a reasonable doubt that the testing method and the results themselves prove beyond a reasonable doubt that somebody was over a legal limit. To find otherwise, I mean, the state talks about the benefit of the bargain and their concerns about that. Mr. Humane has very similar concerns about the fact that, you know, this is all circumstantial evidence of impairment that's brought up in the complaint and the police reports. None of that was tested via cross-examination. No jury unanimously found that it unerringly pointed to impairment and couldn't be rationally explained by other circumstances, other explanations. It's a far cry to say that would have led to a conviction. In terms of at a trial, if somebody's tired, if English is their second language, if they're suffering.
English was the second language of your client?
No, there wasn't a trial, and that's the point.
I'm going from what the district court was relying on. It said, and you can correct me, the appellant was asleep or unconscious behind the wheel of a vehicle with a running engine, had bloodshot and watery eyes, was slow to respond to police, responded inaudibly or unintelligibly to question, could not recite the alphabet, and performed poorly on field tests. Sounds like drunk to me.
Without being subjected to cross-examination in front of a jury of his peers?
What would you like to be subjected to on those facts?
I don't have enough time. I mean, there's, when it comes to that, there is a lot from the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration doesn't even want officers to use bloodshot, watery eyes as a cue for alcohol consumption.
If it's bloodshot, watery eyes, that's a problem, but I mean, this seems like your classic slumper to me.
Well, and that's just it, is that none of that was tested at trial. There's lots of cases where somebody is convicted of being over the legal limit and acquitted.
He pled guilty, right? Because presumably if he thought if he went to trial, probably not great facts, right?
In a situation like this, and again, we're getting way into the realm of speculation, but here, yes, he assumed that there was no way a jury would not convict him based on these blood test results, and there'd be no benefit to going to trial.
He's charged with two counts, right?
Correct.
Test and road driving.
Correct. And in situations...
It's not just blood test, it's driving or being in control of the vehicle with a blood test of one way or more, right?
Correct. There was no driving conduct to speak of one way or the other. No, but it's helpful for a conviction if the state can point to driving conduct. And so,
do you think it's one of the facts in this case, as I understand it, that's different than many cases, is that your client did call an attorney and consult with an attorney.
Correct.
Before consenting. Do you think that has an impact on our analysis?
In the past, it has had an impact with respect to going back to the Brooks case, when determining whether another exception to the warrant requirement existed, such as consent. That didn't get litigated significantly at the district court. The state has raised that as an option, as an alternate theory on appeal. I think with that specific argument, that's not supported by the record. Most of what's in the record establishes that this was not consensual, that Mr. Yamani didn't want to take the test. He did refuse a urine test. He's got his affidavit into the record. After the Fagan decision came down, the Supreme Court highlighted how these challenges should be expected to proceed at the district court, where we allege that there was no warrant and no exception. The state can choose which exceptions they think do apply, and then the burden does shift back to us to sort of prove a negative, but to show that there were no exigent circumstances and there were no consent. That didn't happen here. Fagan was pending while this was going. So in addition to the initial relief we were requesting, that the court vacate this conviction, remand it for sentencing as a gross misdemeanor, I'm also asking in the alternative for a remand so that we can actually have that hearing, have the pleadings conform with those new standards in Fagan, and then maybe we do explore if the state thinks it's appropriate, whether there were exigent circumstances or whether there was free and voluntary consent, and the district court would be in a position to evaluate that at that point. But I don't think it's appropriate to determine that Mr. Yamani could have been convicted of something else. I mean, that completely defeats the purpose of giving somebody this core trial right, all of the rights we expect people to waive when they enter a guilty plea. And he did plead guilty, but it was specifically to an offense that requires blood alcohol concentration evidence as a essential element of the conviction.
So you think our analysis in Nordstrom was wrong?
Reading Nordstrom, it was correct, because that person was convicted of driving while impaired, where you could look at it as a sort of sufficiency of the evidence in that specific case. When you're dealing with impairment, all of those factors come into play. I'm not the biggest fan of doing sufficiency of the evidence analysis when there was no trial conducted, but on its face, Nordstrom is fine, and for our purposes, doesn't compel the same result, strictly because it was a completely different offense with one key different element that Mr. Yavani was convicted of, because in Nordstrom, this court was right. That person absolutely could have been convicted absent any sort of alcohol concentration evidence whatsoever. And a factual basis for a plea could be supported with nothing more than those other indicia of impairment. Whereas here, even the plea itself is invalid if you take away the alcohol concentration evidence. If he's not agreeing that he was above the legal limit based on that test, there's no factual basis for the plea. And that's where the collateral attack comes from. And again, it's premised on this unique swing where the legal landscape has done several 360s before we got to where we are today. But I think that on the whole, this is similar enough to Nordstrom, where that's the appropriate framework for analysis, but Nordstrom itself reached one conclusion based on what the driver was convicted of. And because Mr. Yamani was convicted of a different offense that does require alcohol concentration evidence, the opposite result should come about. If there are no further questions from the panel, I'll reserve my remainder for rebuttal. Thank you.
I will now hear from counsel to respond,
please. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jordan Rood, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, representing the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. This court should affirm the district court's ruling in this case for three reasons. First, the district court correctly determined that even if the warrantless blood test in this 2013 case is excluded, there is still sufficient evidence to proceed on a general DWI offense based on other evidence of appellant's impairment. Second, because appellant pleaded guilty to this 2013 offense, his collateral challenge is waived. And third, there are two exceptions to the warrant requirement that would apply in this case, specifically the good faith exception and the consent exception.
Speaking for myself and not the panel, I didn't think I would go from good faith. And I mean, I thought consent under these circumstances is not permitted anymore, Mr. Rood, that you've got to get a warrant. Am I wrong?
Well, in my brief, I cited State v. Brooks. Which the facts are, I would say, almost identical to this case. In Brooks, it was a situation where there was some evidence of impairment. The driver was asked to take, I believe, it was a couple different incidents, take several tests, consented to tests, and then argued that that consent was not voluntary. The Minnesota Supreme Court found that there was consent by examining the totality of the circumstances in that case, specifically whether there was probable cause to believe that a DWI offense had occurred, whether the police followed the procedure for the implied consent process when interacting with the driver, and whether the driver was given the opportunity to speak with an attorney. And in Brooks, the court found that based on the totality of circumstances, there was consent. And there, the same, almost identical set of facts occurs in this case. The police did have probable cause to believe that appellant had committed a DWI offense when they found him, as Your Honor stated, slumped over, unintelligible responses, performed poorly on a couple of field sobriety tests. And additionally, the record, which is the police report in this case, shows that the police followed the proper procedure. They read the implied consent advisory, asked if you would consent to testing. And finally,
at that time, said refusal is a crime.
That's right. And that is also the case in Brooks. And finally, appellant was given the opportunity to speak with an attorney and did speak with an attorney before consenting to the tests. And so, based on Brooks, there was consent in this case.
Drew, what do you think of the appellate counsel's argument that, well, you know, he pled to the OA charge, not DUI, so we should be focusing on the OA charge and not be concerned with the other indicia of impairment?
Counsel is correct that Nordstrom is not identical to this case. And of course, it's an unpublished case and not binding, but the district court found that it is persuasive.
Why is it persuasive?
Because, first, I would note that appellant was charged with a general DWI offense in addition to the per se offense. And I would also note that appellant, although counsel has noted that he, I guess he would subject some of the facts in this case to cross-examination, their appellant has not disputed the facts of that incident. And I think in his brief, appellant notes that the only fact of consequence is the existence of this conviction. And so I'd say that other evidence is not disputed, and I do not have that information, Your Honor. And so I would say that while Nordstrom is not identical, it's not distinguishable, because we have a situation where general DWI offense was charged and where there is evidence in the record, both in 2013 and in 2018, of other evidence of impairment that would be sufficient for the state to proceed on that charge. And that's also State v. Schmidt, which is a more recent, and that's a published decision, which was a sort of similar situation where they saw, where the, I believe that's a Supreme Court case that said that the state could still proceed for a general DWI offense without the test results based on other evidence of impairment.
So are you focusing on the language, Mr. Rubenschmidt, that only in unique cases may a defendant collaterally attack a prior conviction to present its use as an enhancement? Is that what we should be looking at?
I think that is important as well, yes, Your Honor. And that also goes to the second argument that I wanted to make, that this collateral challenge is waived, which is slightly different. But appellant relies on Johnson v. State to say that he is able to collaterally attack this 2013 conviction. I would first note that Johnson is distinguishable from this case, because in Johnson, the Minnesota Supreme Court focused on the fact that the appellant was challenging the constitutionality of the statute for which he was convicted. That's not the case here. Appellant is not challenging the constitutionality of the DWI statute. He's challenging his, the test result, test refusal, sorry, statute that was in place at the time. So that's the first reason why this is waived. And then I would also note that allowing this collateral attack would prevent the state from getting the benefit of the plea bargain that was made in 2013, and that's State v. Coles. The state offered to dismiss the second charge in exchange for a plea to this this per se conviction, with the understanding that this conviction could enhance a subsequent DWI offense. And so allowing this attack would prevent the state from getting that benefit from the bargain. I believe that's right, Your Honor.
And this was not, right? This was just a plea.
Yes.
Does that make a difference? Because in the stipulated facts, he's agreeing, you know, presumably to all of that facts related to the conduct. And here, since I assume he was pleading, since he was pleading the OA, I assume, there's none of this language about, the offer day and all the rest of this stuff, right?
I believe that's right. I would say, excuse me, that in Nordstrom, this court looked at what was in the record that could support a general DWI conviction. And in this case, the court can also look at what's in the record. And in that case, it's not a stipulated facts trial or anything like that, but it is the police report. Which, I would know was not disputed. And so I believe that that's sufficient in this case to provide other evidence of impairment.
As I understand it, the information that the court relied on was the complaint in the police reports?
Yes.
If I agree
Yes.
In this case?
I believe so. Unless there are any further questions from the panel?
No, I just wanted to make sure, you know, that the argument's been made that in Nordstrom, there was a general DWI law that was at stake there. And the court held in that case, you could go under any one of the, you could go either way. You could go with the blood alcohol level, and you could prove it with other evidence. In this case, there were two specific charges, unlike Nordstrom. One was the .08 charge, and the other one was the general DWI statute. And then he basically pled guilty to the .08. And as I understand the argument of the appellant, is that makes this distinguishable, because all that, I mean, unlike the Wisconsin case where it was just the one charged under the general DWI, we have two separate charges here. And that this analysis wouldn't fit here because there are two distinct separate charges. How do you respond to that? How should we address it?
Well, I agree that it's not an identical situation. It is different. But I believe what makes this case similar enough and what makes Nordstrom persuasive is the fact that there was a general DWI charge in the case and that there is evidence that would support such a charge. That's, you know, at a broader level, I think that's very similar to what this court decided in Nordstrom.
Was the degree of the admission of the underlying facts. Do we have a sufficient degree of admission of these underlying facts that existed in Nordstrom? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
It sounds like the only thing we have on this record, or based on what I know of this record, unless you tell me otherwise, is the complaint. And we have a completely separate charge. Is the admission of the underlying facts here, sufficient? With just relying on that complaint?
Yes.
And that's why I ask you, was there a plea here or something that indicated that there was an admission of these underlying facts? Because otherwise, aren't we being asked to basically assume the validity of a complaint? And I know that there was no contest of the complaint, but there was a need for there to be a contest because they picked one of the charges.
Yes, I understand your question, Your Honor. I would say that I think it's instructive that there was, as you say, no dispute at the time, and there's also no dispute now as to the facts of this case. And that's based on both the complaint and on the police report, which was in the record in 2018 and I believe in 2013. I might be wrong about that. I'm not sure. And so I think that it's not identical, but I think that there is enough before this court and what was before the district court to find that Nordstrom is persuasive.
So you think that this, the existence of a police report without more is sufficient for us to find that there's enough evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that he would have been convicted under the other charge as well?
On the facts of this case, yes, I do, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rude.
Thank you.
We'll now hear for counsel for respondent, please.
May it please the court. in terms of the sufficiency of the evidence, again, I think it's helpful to distinguish between the standard used for sufficiency of the evidence after a verdict, where you're looking at everything in a light most favorable to the jury's verdict, giving them every benefit of the doubt, discounting everything that contradicts that verdict. Under that standard, there probably is enough here to say he was guilty of being impaired. But I don't think that's the appropriate standard at all based on this challenge, given that that charge was dismissed. I mean, there was no verdict. He didn't even agree, based on this record, that he was impaired. And he may have very well thought he wasn't, again, speculating, but he may have said, the only thing I know I think I'm guilty of is being over the legal limit. So I don't think on this record there are enough facts to support the district court's determination to say, all right, this conviction was unconstitutional, but I'm effectively going to almost sua sponte reinstate a conviction for a different offense based on some of the facts that were alleged years ago. The only other point I want to briefly address is appellant's or respondent's reliance on Brooks. I would point out at the time Brooks came down dealing with consent, the legal assumption was that the implied consent law was constitutional. So the whole decision was colored by the assumption that it was constitutional to threaten somebody with the crime of refusal that was later overturned. So I don't think Brooks carries as much weight as respondent wants it to. And we now have the Johnson and Morehouse decisions that are dealing with the fact that this, the unconstitutional refusal law did directly impact people that gave in to that unconstitutional threat and did submit to testing, which again, this is a unique enough case where a collateral attack, you know, is warranted.
Can I ask you about the remedy? I mean, because it sounds like there's a, first of all, your client did receive the benefit of a bargain. There was a charge dismissed, correct?
Correct. He couldn't have been sentenced on both, but
but you haven't asked for a plea withdrawal or anything like that?
No, the remedy is very narrow in this case. He's not asking for that conviction to be vacated. The only remedy is asking for its use against him in these enhancement proceedings to be prohibited. It may be that may be more form over substance, but that's the request here.
I mean, but doesn't that give him a benefit that he that's more than what he bargained for here.
And he does. I mean, he served his sentence. The state got the majority of their bargain. He is getting a benefit. But at the same time, I mean, the district court found, you know, this conviction was obtained in violation of his constitutional rights.
The result would be, I mean, if in fact there, if you wanted to rewind the clock and redo it, you know, and throw out that evidence, then the state would have the opportunity to go on the second charge and prove up the second charge. But you're saying the state doesn't get that right, and that, in fact, they not only don't get that right, but you also get the benefit as if, you know, of not having to even deal with that second charge that had been previously dismissed.
And I am coming at it from conceptually a little different standpoint, because they still got their conviction. Mr. Yamani still served his sentence, but I don't think it is a foregone conclusion that a jury would have convicted Mr. Yamani of being impaired. And so, I mean, they did have the chance to take that to trial, and they chose to, as part of the agreement, dismiss a count that, and again, speculating that Mr. Yamani was allowing them to dismiss the one where he's like, I think I could win that at trial, or his counsel thought he could win it at trial. And they pled to the over 08. So, no, and I think whenever there's a collateral attack that succeeds because somebody's rights were violated, there is going to be that residual, and now it can't be used for enhancement. I think that's just, I can't think of a way to avoid that. The question is just whether or not there was a constitutional violation or not.
In this case, he did plead following a stipulated facts trial of felony driving while impaired. So it wasn't a plea to the OA charge, it was a stipulated facts trial, right?
Yes, we're here today based on a Lothenbach or a stipulated facts bench trial.
And And as part of that, below at the district court, the defense counsel tried to exclude the evidence of this 213 conviction, and then the state supplemented the record with the police report, which contained all these details. So at that point, and the district court denied that motion to exclude that conviction. So, I mean, I guess my question is, then why doesn't all this stuff loop come in? I mean, it seems to me there was a hearing as to any of this. You agreed to stipulated facts. I guess the police report comes in. So, why should we, in looking at this record for the collateral attack, not take a look at all that evidence of other impairment?
I mean, I see that I'm out of time. May I answer the court's question? It's respondent's or appellant's position that evidence isn't actually relevant because of the charge he was convicted of. And so whether it's in the record or not, it can be read to death. I mean, arguably, hypothetically, Mr. Yamani could have said to law enforcement, man, am I drunk. I still don't think that would rise to the level where we can say, yep, the conviction for over 08 was unconstitutional. We're going to effectively reinstate a conviction for something he wasn't convicted of. Like, I think it's that bad. So that's why I'm asking that the court either vacate Mr. Yamani's conviction and remand this for sentencing, or remand for a hearing on whether any exceptions to the warrant requirement exist. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted. Our next case this morning is...